This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're celebrating our 100th episode of Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. This one, if you include bonus episodes and re-releases, actually ended up being 101, but we were just so keen to sneak in our Christmas episode last week in time when we found that wonderful organisation not very long before Christmas. So I'm glad we were able to turn that around, and here is our celebration of 100 episodes now instead. So to start off...
You're really like... you know, cool and chilled about it. You just take it all in your stride, and you know, I'm actually excited the fact that the live show, actually, Bob, the live show is my year with you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because you started in February.
I did.
Wow.
I actually first met you on my birthday, just after my birthday that we do it.
Magic. If we spoke to Marcus, he would say we manifested it.
yeah. But sorry to interrupt you there, Bobby, but I'm just like so excited for the fact your achievement, like, on all these episodes. It's amazing work you've been doing. Maybe should have waited that to the end and done a little speech, but I couldn't stop myself.
You can come back. We can have more speech. But, no, I do agree. I think, well, first of all, you've been a massive part of that as well. You've been so wonderful to work with, so I'm delighted to have you on board and you sticking around into the new year. But also, I think, for me, because this is... something that's just so a part of my routine now, I can sometimes just get kind of used to that I wouldn't at any point want to not have this show. Like, it's such a part of my life, and it's actually got me to prioritize mental health, both my own and talking about and checking in on it in other people as well. That is kind of just now a big part of my identity. But I guess in a way, because it's also part of my routine and this weekly thing, I can, I think, take it for granted.
Yeah.
But sometimes you think about it and it's just madness to think at this point there's roughly 90 hours of us having mental health conversations on the internet. Like, that's so much content.
Wow.
For TV programs, that's, you know, several seasons. On that note, talking of people being excited, Milan is making noises, my cat. So... I'm going to quickly nudge her into another room. She's obviously very excited about this too. Bear with. So we're back. And yeah, I think we'll leave that bit in because that's something that the listeners don't get to hear, that Milan is generally pretty good. She, well, at least historically, she'll see the mics come out and then she'll know that's her cue to kind of go to sleep. Otherwise, she's going to be kicked out. But I think particularly as a house cat that doesn't go outside, her whole world is the people that come and go. And so I think recently she's been finding it extra exciting, all our brilliant guests that come in. And she takes that as an excuse to go really hyper when we're trying to record.
Yeah, but Bobby's one of those people, you know, like a parent that doesn't actually want to slag the kid off, but the kid's a nightmare. Milan has been great in the first half of the year. And Bobby would say, she's not normally like this. She behaves very well. And generally she does. This last few months, Bobby, brilliant. I'm like, Bob, we've been saying this now. I think what it was when the mics first came out, what, 18 months, nearly 2 years ago, 2 years, she didn't like them and went to sleep. Now she's like cocky with them. She's not bothered. She thinks, I don't care if the mics isn't there. I don't have a queue anymore. Mics can come out. People can come and go. This is my house, my place, and I'm not bothered what's going on. So we've had to be mindful of Milan more than we have had to do in the past, but she's still never a problem. We don't mind a little meow now and again.
Yeah, occasionally they do make their way onto the recordings, but Pete generally, being the professional that he is, crops them out, so...
Yeah, gorgeous. Milan is beautiful.
But yeah, I mean, it's all good fun, and it's all a... I'm going to turn it into a positive. It's all a reflection of our commitment to this podcast. Because even last week, I don't know yet, because we're recording this before the episode is edited, but the episode that's coming out before this one, I have flu currently, and I'm on the mend, but I was definitely sicker that day. So between that and one of the guests also being ill, you can probably hear like Lemsip mugs being put up and down on a table. But yeah, that is the commitment we have to this show. Would I recommend working through having flu? That rhymed. No, I would not. But sometimes I've had to do these things and cancel other things because we still have the commitment of getting this show out regularly. But I'm definitely on the mend now. Hopefully I'm not sounding too nasally today. Yeah.
You're not getting through it.
Cool. So anyway, back to our 100th episode. So yeah, we're super excited. I thought what would be fun, which I've not done for a while, is to look at a few of the stats. I find it interesting, so hopefully the listeners will do too. And also it links to a fun project I've got coming up as well. So in terms of the show, since we moved to Audio Boom in July, who hopefully you'll remember are the people responsible for our ads changing and who support us in growing and developing the show. Through the new year, we should also be working with them further to upgrade our ads to have more host-read ones. So as well as the radio ads you hear that are pre-recorded, you'll also hear us talking about products as well. Basically, that's something that you get a much higher rate of return for. And as the podcast isn't yet profitable, that's a definite milestone we're hoping to reach next year. So from our stats with Audio Boom, they've listed the top countries that listen to the podcast. One is the United Kingdom, two is the United States, followed by Ireland, Canada, and Australia. So the UK still makes up the majority of our listeners, but it is always quite surreal when you look at all the places we have listeners in. I'm not particularly surprised that we have English-speaking countries dominating there. The sixth one is France. And then another thing I found really interesting was our stats in terms of most popular episodes. So number one was Relationships and Mental Health, part one. So the first half of our mini-series about relationships and mental health. I was so delighted with how that one turned out. So it's really great to see how many people have connected with it. The second most popular has been our trailer. I think a lot of that is to do with all the new listeners we're very lucky to have found or have found us. And third is Sex, which was the one we did with Elaine Miller, all about all the vast, vast ways in which sex can influence our mental health. Then Overcoming Failure and Confidence and OCD were the fourth and the fifth. So part of the reason why I'm so excited about these is I'm working on a new project, which up till now has been completely secret, which is a second podcast, this time all about relationships. So this one will be a lot more lighthearted. I will be interviewing mainly comedians and friends of mine, because I think I have the coolest friends. And certainly, I seem to have a lot of people around me with big opinions about relationships. I feel like it's not a coincidence. So that show I've started recording, and it'll be coming out in early 2020. We don't yet have a date for it, but I will let you guys know. So that's really exciting to see that there's already a demand in our listeners for relationship and sex related content. So
a sexy audience, obviously.
That must be it. So, well, I think also this is really universal stuff. So whilst I think in many ways this show is very direct about how we try and tackle stigma, I think there's such value in that. So there's a lot of mental health or well-being related shows that have popped up even since we started this one. There's clearly a growing audience, and shows like ours growing, I think, gives other potential podcasters ideas, which is exciting. But I think none of them match us in terms of us being so focused on anti-stigma. There's a lot of them that can be more vague talking about mental health, or they'll use the term well-being because that can feel like a softer or safer term, but to us that can be a sign of the stigma. So we really try and be very direct here. But I think there's also value in the new podcast being a lot more informal You know, I still think, in a way, even if this is just a benefit, I find it's really great hearing people that I look up to, people like comedians who are very articulate and seem very like they've got the world figured out a lot of the time. You know, they've got really cohesive, funny narratives and takes on things. And yet we can all have issues with relationships. And particularly dating in the modern age will be a big component of that show.
Absolutely. And to be honest, Bobby, they're so well linked, the shows. And the fact that it's in mental, there's certain conduct, there's respect to the illness, there's a lot that we put into that, to make sure, as you said, we get it right. Whereas on this one, it's all subjective stories and experiences, and it'll be fun. But the link is the fact that it's not just dating relationships, all relationships that we have an impact on us, and most of the things that we are driven by through our mental illness come from other people or things that may have happened to us or experiences that we've had. So it all ties in so nicely. But for the listeners to really get to see two sides to you, and for you to be able to relax and just really enjoy interviewing the comedians whom and which you love will be so much fun. I'm really excited about it. And co-host is pretty cool too.
Yeah, I think, listeners, you'll really love her. She's one of the funniest people I've ever known. We're really good friends. And in the intros, we just kind of chat nonsense. We try and sort of loosely cover a theme. We've recorded a few of those intros so far. But honestly, it's, you know, it's fun. And we find a lighthearted way to dissect what can be quite serious factors in what makes a good relationship or how to get into a relationship in the first place. So, yeah, Ronnie is really ace, and I'm so excited to be championing her as well.
I think people will learn a lot.
I think I'm going to learn a lot. Not to make it about me, but I have a lot of opinions on relationships, but I'm very open to learn, and I think I've really appreciated how much I've learned through mental. So I'm looking forward to people coming on that journey with us. So, yeah, as I said, that will be coming out early 2020. We have artwork from the same artist, Alex Cabell, who did the mental artwork, so they'll look quite similar. It's very exciting. So, back to talking about mental. Is there anything else you wanted to share, Danielle, about your time being part of the show?
Oh, where do I start? No, I'm not going to start. I'm not going to say much, just that I'm just inspired by it, and it's been great working with you and, you know, meeting you. And I've never met, which I love, anybody like you in so many ways. And I just want to interview you every week, don't I? So what about this? And what do you think of this? And what do you think of this? And, you know, it's just been enlightening. I've really enjoyed it. And I'm not going to, you know, this isn't a homage to you, but, you know, personally and professionally, I think you are an amazing guy. You've been brilliant to get to know on both levels, you know, equally. And also, but then to the, you know, I'm really, really proud of what we've delivered. And I'm proud of the fact that, you know, even just to hear you say, how many hours of content potentially?
I think about 90.
90 hours of content of conversations about mental health and mental illness. What a contribution.
It is difficult to wrap your head around, but thank you so much for saying all of that. I've absolutely loved getting to know you. And this is something that the listeners don't know. You're absolutely right. We have such incredible chats off the mic to the point where we regularly talk about, should we just have a podcast where we just chat?
I should come in and the mics should be all set up already, like quietly in the corner, and I just come into work and we just start chatting, and I don't think Pete, our producer, would be happy with giving him like 6 hours of conversation.
Could you imagine? Bless him.
But yeah, well done, Bob. Really well deserved, and, you know, wish you all the luck in the world for 2020.
Thank you. And another thing we should 100% mention as well, which we've been blown away by in the support of, is the petition, because this episode is going out as our first one of 2020, the same year that mental health education is being rolled out across England and Wales, something that we've been pushing for nearly since the podcast started. It wasn't that long after launching it that we launched that campaign. We've got hundreds of thousands of signatures on it, and it's been just incredible to see the response and see areas of government actually taking note, inviting us to be part of consultations, taking on board feedback. And, you know, we've really pushed for this to be as broad and full, I guess, education as is at all possible. So I have so much faith in how this is going to change lives. And as much as we love doing the podcast and we are so overwhelmed by the level of support, at the end of the day, we're here to reduce stigma. And having a show like this has been a gateway into that campaign, into making it such a success. There's still work to be done. We still will continue for the whole of the UK to be covered, so Northern Ireland and Scotland as well. But we have initial support there. We've got initial support from Nicola Sturgeon, just to name one person. So there is a lot of work to do, but the progress has been incredible, and the impact, I think it's difficult for us to even fathom at this point. We're just so grateful for everyone that signed the petition, that shared it, that's listened to this show, that's got behind the whole movement. It would be nowhere without our listeners. And yeah, it just makes me emotional to even think about. Even the petition, like, people leave comments on it. They leave comments of support. And I think I looked it up because you could download a template, and it was something like 60,000 comments of support we'd received. Like, as wow. As an individual, I can't even wrap my head around taking that in. You know, I literally thought to myself, maybe I should wallpaper a room with this stuff, because I don't imagine how I'd ever feel useless with all that support just documented around me.
Well, it's amazing. And I think as well, as a mom thinking that of young children, thinking that they could be within their education, they could learn about mental health, just managed because that's what we do, is just amazing. And also the fact that I'm a youth mental health first aid instructor, when I speak about it to any people that I work with, or anybody that I'm coaching, or any work that I do in that arena, especially for the young people are just bowled over by it and just so happy that there's work that's being done that could potentially change, you know, everything. So absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, 100% agree.
And that's why on New Year's Eve, when you bury your head and get pissed off about what you haven't achieved, you think to yourself, wow, a campaign like changing lives and contributing, forget anything else, but contributing. There's people out there that feel better because of the work that you do, and potentially will change the whole dynamic, that's the wrong word, the whole outlook of young people today within, from an education point of view. If nothing else in the world, they're two huge achievements, and I really, you know, want you to be proud of that.
Oh, thank you.
Sorry.
You just always have the coach perspective, don't you?
I know.
But no, you're right. It is something I'm 100% working on. It's a tricky one at times, I think, with mental health, to separate what is a part of your personality and what is a part of your illness. You know, like, that definitely relates to my depression, but then also me being so hard on myself throughout the year is a big part of why I push to get so much done and have projects like this where I'm self-employed. I created the demand for this podcast by, you know, creating the podcast. Like, nobody was waiting for an episode every Thursday until I made it happen. So I'm aware that it's in a large part self-inflicted pressure. But at the same time, I find it incredibly helpful to my mental health. You know, I would never think twice about bringing up mental health in a conversation now. You know, I wasn't even aware that I was doing that. But now it's just something that, if anything, I don't need to bring up at all, because it's just such a part of how people see me. And it'll be interesting with the new podcast about relationships, how that changes as well. I feel like, if anything, that will be the one that I'm then holding back talking about. The challenge will be then having a relationship podcast whilst dating. I'm thinking to myself, I don't think I can mention this to them.
Yeah, I know, it's such a thing. It's like me and all my friends. Like, I've been with my guy for so many years, like years and years, and all my friends know him really well and have known him, some of them, before I even knew them.
Right.
And a lot of my girlfriends are single, And so, like, when they're all sharing dating stories or traumas or dramas or exciting things and experiences they've had on these dates or sex experiences or whatever, I'm always the one that has to sit there, like, silent because I know, you know, my boyfriend. Like, we're all really, like, they've all known him for years, so I feel like I can never share. Everybody else shares because there's no, like, conflict of interest. And I'm always like, I want to share with my girls and I can't. And that'll be you. Start dating and we'll see what happens to the podcast.
I mean, that is a question I've had from some people already. What will happen if you get in a relationship? And I think I'll still continue it. I just have a slightly different perspective on it. But it really does say something, doesn't it, that it feels more vulnerable at this point to talk about dating and relationships than it does to talk about mental health, including, you know, diagnoses, including some of the most difficult times in my life. You know, I think that really says something about how hard I've worked to reduce stigma for everyone I can, including myself. Yeah. So I am grateful for that.
And to be fair, Bobby, you're not going to date anyone who isn't open and able to...
Oh, yeah. Could you imagine if they...
like, don't ever speak about me, or don't, you know, you're just not going to date anyone who's going to be like that. So I don't think you've even got that as in even a consideration. They're going to be cool, and if they're not, I can't see you hanging around, to be honest.
Thank you. Well, I think that's very true, and I'm certainly not expecting anyone to last for very long who has really backwards views about mental health.
Exactly.
Because I do get that sometimes. The vast majority of people I meet are just bowled over by this work and are really positive about it. It continues to be surreal when I meet people that have already listened to the show or me being interviewed on other podcasts and so recognise my voice but not my face. I think that'll never stop being weird. But occasionally I do have it where you mention it and then somebody just goes silent and awkward.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is they're often the people that could probably do with listening to a show like this most. But, you know, you've got to meet people where they're at and...
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like we're getting into relationship podcast territory. Yeah. So we'll have to definitely get you on as a guest for that soon. Right, so we'll start wrapping up there. Is there anything else you wanted to say before we get into this episode?
No, I think we've said it all.
Okay, and what we haven't mentioned is the interview for this episode. So I had the incredible privilege to interview Danielle, and I'm really glad to do this given how much our listenership has boomed recently. A lot of people are coming in new to the show. The interview will give a lot of background on where Danielle is coming from in terms of her contribution to this show, a lot of the experiences she's had or that have happened through her family that have really shaped her perspective and her incredible investment in ending mental health stigma. So I was so glad to cover all of that with you. The theme for the episode is outlook. So you'll hear a lot about what makes someone like Danielle so proactive and so perfect, really, to be a coach. You know, we talked a bit about earlier the conversations we have off air. A lot of those are really bigging me up. Like, nobody is as big a cheerleader for me as Danielle. And that is incredible because a show like this is emotional. You know, I don't always feel my best, but, you know, that's real. And, you know, the strength to continue talking about real emotions and connecting with new guests is something that is in part thanks to her and Pete and the incredible support I have personally outside of that. So is there anything you want to say about your interview, Danielle?
No, it was great. I think it'll go down as I've interviewed lots and lots of people in my work. And that's my first interview for a podcast. So all the work and what 2020 is going to hold with various podcasts and shows and lots of different things. How cool is it that I think it's fitting, actually, that the 100th episode of yours will be my first interview on a podcast. It's really cool. So thanks for interviewing me.
No, of course. It's great to hear the novelty of you being on the other side of it. Although I imagine you feel well practiced doing all these intros. Grand. So we'll get into that episode with the wonderful Danielle Hogan in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
So my first experience with mental illness comes from seeing pain, I think,
feeling pain, seeing pain myself, and not really wouldn't have known at 7 or 8 years old that it was anything to do with what was going on in my head. You know, it was all about a feeling that that was happening to me and happening to those people around me. So it's only in hindsight that I can really probably say that would be my first experience with mental illness, because it was just being in an environment that was surrounded by like despair,
mm-hmm.
you know, really deep pain that affected how people were behaving.
And what had caused that?
So when I was 8 years old, year three, maybe something like that, I was 7 or 8 years old. And I remember a teacher walked into my classroom with a post-it note saying that I had to leave the classroom, which never happened. Mum was always at work full time, like for as long as I can remember. So somebody's here to collect you in the middle of the day. And when I got back to my grandmother's house, I'd found out that my mum's brother had taken his own life.
Right. And at that young age, how were you told what had happened?
Was I even told? Did I just hear? You know, is what I've often thought. Did anybody actually sit down and say, Uncle Michael's not here anymore? Or did I just hear? I feel like I just heard them say, Michael's committed suicide. Michael's committed suicide. Just hearing that all the time. And she couldn't cope. You know, my mum, her twin sister, my grandmother, they weren't in a position. I don't feel that I was ever brought into that situation. I was brought home when they just found out. Like, yeah. I feel like they were in bed crying in despair. My mum, who'd have been, I don't know, in her 20s, I guess. Yeah, she was 20, when she would have been 27, 28. So I feel like I was brought into a situation that was highly emotive and despairing almost, you know, rather than a, okay, we're bringing you home from school, we've got something to tell you, this has happened 3 days ago. Like most kids probably go through, most people who are in the moment of it, it's just there. There's nowhere for me to go to be protected from this instant emotion. I was just in it.
Yeah, you never expect to lose a sibling at that age.
No.
You know, the shock of it must have been so difficult for everyone to wrap their head around.
That's the word, probably. That's the absolute word. That's what I remember seeing, the shock, like a trembling almost, you know, like that, like, what? I can't believe what's going, you know, that shock was what it was. So there was no room in their mind to approach me. Like, no, you couldn't, I can't even process what I'm hearing is that my brother's taken his own life. I can't deal with my child.
Mm-hmm. How aware do you think your family were of how bad things were for him previously?
Well, it's funny because only through speaking to my mum a few years ago did I even know that he'd been seeing a doctor and that he was suffering with depression. Like, we speak really openly about stuff, and I've always known that this is a thing in our family. It's never been hidden, but we've never really gone into it, which is unusual because we go into most stuff. And I just knew that something had happened in his world, I'll leave it at that. And then that had made him have an instant reaction. That's what I always grew up believing, that he went and did it from an instant moment of despair from his own world, not knowing that he'd been through months of depression.
And so at that time, it sounds like you weren't really sure on what had happened. I imagine at that age, certain terms like suicide were still kind of unfamiliar to you. Do you remember how much you understood?
That he'd killed himself. That's what I knew. What I knew suicide was. That's what I heard through talking to other people, through hearing the conversations probably to other people. Because imagine my experience, and my mum could sit with me now and she could have a completely different experience. So no way what I'm saying is what is the truth of what happened. It's just what I know is my experience and my recollection. I remember phone calls happening, like when you know, when somebody dies or there's some kind of trauma in a family, somebody has to be the caller of like partners, workplace, you know, everybody suddenly starts, you know, this communication, you don't just go quiet in a room. Just hearing that, I knew instantly. I remember knowing instantly that he'd done it. I don't think things have ever normalised, which I love. I love not being normal. But I don't know. I don't know if I had time off school. I don't know. You know, my mum was under a lot of pressure anyway. She was on her own and she worked full time. So I was one of those kids that was the first one at school, or the first one with childcare and the last one to be picked up. You know, I was the breakfast and after school club kid, mm-hmm. right? First one in the door, last one out. So she'd have been under a lot of pressure. I guess she'd have got time off work, but she'll tell stories now that, like, when she had me at 20, she got 3 weeks if she wanted to keep the job that they'd just given her. She worked for a bank, that she had to be back at work for 3 weeks. And that, for them in 1980, was a good thing. You know, they were being kind. You were 20, you were junior. And if you want the job, you can, but you come back in 3 weeks. So I was 3 weeks old when I went into full-time childcare. And there'd have been, I think there was a lady at the bottom of the road near my grandparents, you know, who wasn't, like, probably shipped off to a nursery, but I was at nursery very, very young, like within that, probably within the first few months. So I don't recall a time of her having much. She'd have had a bit of time off, but there wouldn't have been the privilege to take real time out and to make sure I was okay and to discuss how our emotional well-being was. There would have been none of that.
And that's so often the case that things like this happen. It depends on the privileges of time and money and mm-hmm. space and what you can do. And for a lot of people, they just have to survive. And often that means surviving with whatever support that's out there.
Yeah.
If there's no support, then there's no support.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel now that there's so much more. There's still a way to go, but there's so much more that you could potentially tap into or get support with, even the internet, you know. You could even read if you need to, listen to mental podcasts. But do you know what I mean? There's more now, I think. But then the other side of that is, does that mean that there's more opportunity to not just get on with what you've got to do? You know, the more opportunity to dwell, because there's more opportunity to read and learn and understand and put yourself with other people who may also be struggling. Or did, you know, in 1987, when I was seven, did my mum just go back to work and we all got on with it? I'm not saying that's healthy or the preferred way. I'm just thinking that's probably what happened.
Yeah, and to a degree, that was probably also the social norms of this idea of the British stiff upper lip,
yeah.
that you just keep calm and carry on. And I feel like that's still the same for a lot of people, but particularly with mental health, online resources have been such an asset, because what hasn't changed is GPs had limited time then mm-hmm. and they've still got limited time, arguably even more stretched now. So there is still a lot of onus on the people that need the help to kind of self-educate.
Absolutely.
But then, as we know from campaigning around mental health education, it's so important that kids understand this. Because you were in this situation that's traumatic and incredibly difficult for anyone to go through, let alone a child that has kind of varying degrees of what's going on.
Yeah.
Do you think the school knew?
I don't know, actually. Probably.
Like, some of them, I'm assuming, for you to have been taken out that day.
Probably, but there was no conversation, like, sitting down with anybody ever. Not even my own family. But we got on with it, not in like a taboo way, like hush, hush. There was none of that, because of the fact that he took his own life. This is, again, my experience. My mum's, I couldn't imagine there was ever a, you know, it's that thing to do that we don't really talk about, you know, and the fact that it is even called commit suicide, because it was illegal years ago and still is in some places in the world. It wasn't a taboo because of that, or not spoken about much because of that. It was just the pain. It's just the pain, you know.
Well, it's sort of bittersweet in a way that you didn't have that stigma to deal with that so many people do. But
yeah.
then there wasn't the next step of that, which is the support being there.
Yeah. And I don't think I ever heard my family say once, I don't think I ever heard my mum say, how could he do this to us? Or how could he do it to his children? In fact, I know I've always heard her say, what pain must he have been in to have done that? So my experience of taking your own life is always one that comes with empathy. It always has been. Potentially maybe why I work in the job that I do and the work that I've always done and felt connected to, helping others, because there was always so much empathy. I've been brought up with that.
Yeah,
always.
That's what I thought when you said that it's a very empathetic approach. Because that can happen even with grief across the board. You know, somebody can die of old age even, and there can still be relatives that feel abandoned.
Yeah.
That can be a natural, emotional, if not logical, response. Whereas with suicide, there can be this mentality of, well, they carried it out and therefore they are a bit more blameworthy, and that's part of the stigma. So it's really nice to hear that mental illness wasn't demonised in that way for you. That it is for a lot of people. And so when you went back to school, were you able to do the same, to just carry on with...
I think so.
you know, relatively normal routine.
Yeah, I think so. But then a few years later, my mum's twin sister was sectioned, you know, under the Mental Health Act. Mm-hmm. So she's, that has to be, I mean, she was always probably struggling with her mental health before my Uncle Michael took his own life.
Right.
We've always known that they've been completely different and there's been some issues there. However, you know, she was then sectioned when I was in my teens, and that was more disturbing. Maybe because I was more aware of what was going on. It was more disturbing to see her, you know.
Right. Well, it almost sounds like with what happened with Michael, you were sort of caught up in the sort of family resilience and almost survival mode.
Yeah.
Which in itself is really powerful, and is nice to hear you kind of had that family approach, that you were all kind of united in dealing with it, mm-hmm. and having a certain shared outlook. But then potentially, I guess, when you were older and you understood what was happening more with your aunt.
Different kettle of fish altogether.
Then it's, I guess, more difficult to be wrapped up in like how the family is approaching it.
Yeah.
Because now you've got your own perspectives. Absolutely. You're an older person.
Yeah. Society plays a part, your experiences, not really knowing anybody else that had somebody in their lives that was like mentally ill, and all the words and language that are used that we don't use now, that we shouldn't use, would have come into my head and just been around then. And not in a discriminant, not in a direct way to her, but I might have thought that I had a mad auntie at 15. Like, my auntie's mad, like she's crazy, like, my God. And also it was my own thought and judgment of what an auntie should be, because I had other aunties that were doing different things with me, that would go to the theatre and go to the cinema, and, you know, an auntie that would come and babysit. You know, my mum was young when she had me, so my aunties and uncles, and my dad was even younger, he was 17 and she was 20. My aunties and uncles are young, you know, so when I was young growing up, as the first grandchild as well, my aunties and uncles were like young, late teens, early 20s, so like someone could come and babysit or someone would take me out. You know, I didn't grow up with like elder aunts and uncles, really, but this auntie was never like that. I never spent any time with her on my own. Yet she was an English teacher, fully functional, worked full time. She wasn't like in hospital or anything until she was sectioned. But throughout her whole life, she's always been functional, led her own life, drove a car completely.
Yeah. And in a way, that can make it a lot more difficult to wrap your head around, that she seems so high functioning in other areas. And that's where a lot of the stigma comes from. It's misinformation.
Yeah.
That if you can't understand your aunt's behaviour,
yes.
her behaviour may naturally seem crazy to
Absolutely. You. Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. You're right. In our society now, we can't understand the behaviour. So we think, well, how can you be? Are you putting it on? Are you putting it on? Because you go and teach every day. So how come now when we're saying, let's go out for lunch, you're having a meltdown because you've got this social anxiety that you can't come out of? You know, this, how I'm speaking now, obviously, is me speaking as a younger person and hearing my family members talk about it, the irritation that's in my voice. Obviously, I think a lot differently now. I just have to clarify that. But that irritation was there. And I felt that in our family growing up, that we were irritated by her because there was these meltdowns at inappropriate times, you know, screaming, shouting, nervousness, like complete panic over a small thing that we're doing. And so the world had stopped because my auntie's having a meltdown, and we'd all be like, oh God, here we go again. You know, which loads of families must feel like all the time.
And I think even within that, there can be a kind of hierarchy of mental illness, that somehow it's easier to cope with someone that maybe suffers depression, where their symptoms are quite internal, where they feel very sad and they're very quiet, or anxiety where people aren't around much. These things are supposedly easier to cope with, whereas someone that's quite externally ill and struggling,
yes,
can be quite intense to deal with.
Really intense, because you never knew what was going to happen. And I think for my mum, it was difficult. They were twins. They grew up in the same family. So to be completely different and have a sister, my mum's experience, who was always, would never go along with stuff, would never go out to play with everyone else. You know, my mum would always say, we had one player short on the football pitch when we were playing out, and everybody'd say, bring your sister out. And she'd always be like, no, she won't come out. And my grandparents would smother her and look after her. And then I think that built up issues between them. And obviously for me, being my mum's child, I'd have maybe been on my mum's side, not on a side, but, you know, I've always been like, I love you, auntie. And I'd hug her and kiss her. But I'd always feel maybe that irritation is slightly passed down from my mum. And I don't think she could help that as her twin, and from her experience. I might have judged her over the years at times, though, my mum. When I got into psychology and mental health, I may have thought, mum, how can you treat your sister like that? And it's only in the last few years when I've had a different outlook on how I see thought and experience that I show, you know, have empathy for my mum and think, well, I can't have any judgment on how she treats or has treated her sister because I've not walked in her shoes.
Right, and it's not always conscious. You may have felt a lot of her frustration that she was actively not telling you. She might have been holding back quite a few rants about her sister, but you could still pick up on the annoyance she felt.
Yeah, she's not really held back. And it's funny because it's the one area that she probably has expressed things. When I was saying about my uncle, and even growing up with my dad, I've always known my dad, but I've never lived with him. They were never together, really. My mum has never given me any, she would never say anything negative about other people. So I've always hoped I'd be that parent, you know, parents fall apart and the mum's, you know, pissed off with dad and kids hear stuff. I never heard anything. I saw things for myself. He may have let me down at times and not picked me up on time and all those blah, 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 the millions of kids go through. But she'd still never slag him off. I've never heard her berate anybody, actually. But that situation with my auntie is probably one experience that I see my mum's anxiety come out. She gets like, I'm doing actions that the listeners can't hear, but you know when you kind of grab yourself and huddle. I see my mum's anxiety come out when it's time to talk about my auntie, more so than my uncle.
It's interesting. It almost sounds like it could be partly a reaction that because your auntie's struggles are so external, your mum almost balances it out as her twin.
Yeah.
And is very internal.
Yeah, maybe.
And so through all this, getting to understand what happened with your uncle and what was going on with your aunt, how did your outlook develop around mental health?
You know, when you've seen things firsthand, I remember saying to somebody the day, a friend of mine was on a journey, and I remember her saying to me once, oh my God, I've really realised that you will always be all right. I instantly felt privileged that because of my hardships and what I've seen, absolutely, I've overcome things. And that's where I recognise how powerful our thoughts are and that really they're everything, because I could think about that experience in a way that could send me down a really dark path. Not just that, those experiences. I've had other experiences in my life, but my own mental health has been up and down. But if I didn't think about my experiences in the way that I do, how I think about them will determine the output, you know, what I do really helps me. Right. Because I feel privileged to have felt and to have experienced those things, because it set me up. I wouldn't have wanted potentially to have not had certain experiences in my life.
Yeah, because it's fair to acknowledge that even our own perspectives on our own experiences can still be subjective.
That's all they are.
And that can be one of the incredibly jarring things when you experience mental illness, when other people come in and tell you, oh, it's not that bad. Or, oh, have you considered thinking it this way? Because on one hand, that can be a sign of stigma. It can be a sign of people purposely not empathizing or not knowing how to. But then equally, some people are right, and there is more than one way to look at things. And I think that's a real journey we all have to go through as humans, of figuring out what is objective and what is subjective of our experience.
You're right. There's a thin line, especially when it comes to mental illness and clinical diagnosis of people who are really struggling, that top end. Like, there's no way that medication and therapy don't play a huge part in recovery. Like, I would never come away from, you know, come away from that, really. However, I do believe that nothing on the outside can make us feel. The way that we think about that thing is what makes us feel. So it's something happening that's maybe, I don't know, infidelity, let's say.
Are you thinking of Esther Perel?
Yeah, well, I'd love to be. I mean, we want to meet Esther, don't we? But no, but she would agree, I think, to some extent. So nothing on, you know, if...
Yeah, well, I can phrase it the way she does, if that's helpful. Yeah,
come on.
So Esther Perel, listeners, if you don't know, is a counsellor who specialises in relationships, particularly overcoming infidelity. But one of the things she says is that emotions should be treated as indicators, that they're not 100% accurate, but they're indicators of how we feel. So we may feel upset a particular day, and some days that's because something that's happened that's upsetting, but then equally there's other days where that could be a sign of mental illness or it could be that we're burnt out, that we didn't have enough sleep. There could be a number of reasons why we're upset that isn't something specific.
Yeah.
And within that gap, there's a certain amount of subjectivity.
Yeah.
And I know that from my own experience. I've talked about before when I was at sixth form and I was at times finding that experience really overwhelming. I went to a new school. The people there were from very different backgrounds to where I was. And I would just get so overstimulated by it at times. And I didn't realise at the time I already had depression.
Mm.
And so sometimes I would just pretty much prescribe myself an early night to bed because I was beginning to learn that sometimes I was just exhausted and burnt out.
Yeah.
And that's why I was upset, that no one had actually upset me. I was just overwhelmed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I'd go to bed early. I'd have an extra long sleep, which, I mean, a lot of teenagers need anyway. And then my outlook would be different.
Yeah.
Even though nothing external had changed.
That's the exact example of that fresh thought that we've got millions, even our conversation that we're having now, both of us and our producer will have had millions of thoughts, even while we're talking, different thoughts all the time. And they come and they pop and they go and they change. And it depends which ones we hold on to and which ones we let manifest themselves in different ways as to the way that that determines the rest of the mood, the hour, the day, the month. I just don't think we recognise that power really of the thought. And I mean, we all have these experiences and you and I would respond so differently to one experience. So flying, you don't like flying. I don't mind flying. I think it's just helpful if we all start to recognise that it's not flying. It's the way that Bobby thinks about flying that's the scary thing. It's not flying itself. Otherwise, we'd all be scared of flying, you know? It's those kind of things, really. Even as deep as abuse and love and all of the things in between, you know? How we experience them comes through our thoughts. It's not the thing. Love doesn't make everybody happy. Because love, the word love, could have been detrimental to some people in their lives. So, you know, we'd all say, well, you know what it's like when you're in love, it's amazing. Is it? Christmas, brilliant time of year, is it? It's only that I think Christmas is amazing. I mean, I don't necessarily perfectly, personally.
Right, well, we kind of acknowledge that even in some of the common phrases, like the one that pops to mind for me is rose-tinted spectacles. People talk about some people just seeing a positive on everything.
Yeah.
And I think there's something to that, and that's something we have in common, that we both have a positive outlook. We're very much, to use another cliche, glass half full people.
Yeah, because I'm grateful for my experiences, but I'm definitely not, I definitely can have those low days. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, because that's something that I think comes across in our similarity in terms of how the podcast is structured as well, that we do try and stay on the positive side, that we're here to provide hope. And our guests are examples of people that have been through some really horrific experiences at times, but have got through the other side. And that's the message that we can relate to.
Absolutely. I think that's the message that I would want to always put across. I look at it as like blue sky. It's always there, but the clouds just come in sometimes. And then they block and blind and grey and fuzz it all up. But they're always there. So there is an element of hope, but it's, I believe we can connect to it quite quickly. Like it's always there. We just get a bit clouded, but it doesn't right. necessarily take techniques or do this and then you'll feel better or do that or take this or whatever. I think there's a deeper understanding.
Well, that's a example that can be used in meditation that I've heard used before, that blue sky idea that all our kind of worries and concerns and issues we go through day to day, some of them are things that we need serious support with, and a lot of those issues are covered here on the podcast. But equally, there are smaller frustrations that can really cloud our day. And then the next day it's gone because it's sort of worn off.
Yeah.
And practices like meditation are there to help teach you that the blue sky is still there.
Yeah.
You know, if you've had a frustrating day at work, you're still going home to a home, and a lot of people don't have that. You're still going to sleep in a bed, and a lot of people don't have that. So there's a certain, I guess, like you've used the word privilege quite a few times, there's a certain privilege we have that can be quite consistent in our lives, even if our lives can feel quite erratic.
Yeah, absolutely. That calming, you know, when you come back, which you talk about with meditation, you come back to that calming centre. And I know I talk about privilege because, I mean, for an example, my daughter wrote these beautiful cards the other day to her friends for Christmas. And I, on her own back, I looked at all these envelopes. They've got colours and butterflies and, you know, the Christmas cards for the class. Everybody else has said, to Ella Ray, you know, inside, love from. And she's created these amazing envelopes. And everybody's got a, you know, if your name's Katie, you're, I don't know, that's a wrong, terrible example, Brilliant Bob or whatever. Is that an alliteration?
Yeah.
Everybody's got an alliteration. Delicious, delightful Debbie or whatever. But in a moment, when I looked at them, I had this fear, this well, it wasn't fear. I've called it fear just because my head's telling me it's that. This adrenaline inside, this anxiety, if you like, that made me feel protective. And what would I do if I lost this child? Like, how would I even live tomorrow if she lost me or I lost her? And it overwhelmed me for a minute. Anyway, as I was posting, this was all while I was posting, all these thoughts, millions of them, making these stories up. Oh, my God, what if it happened? And I had this anxiety and then I had this physical reaction to it. I'm posting it. And I suddenly thought, as I put having a child, the love, and I was talking about this love for her and this way that I was feeling, I suddenly thought, oh, my God, I'm so privileged. I can feel this. And it made me smile. And literally, I'm smiling now. How privileged that I get to feel this emotion that 3 seconds ago shit me up. It's scary. And I thought, that's a word that you're just, you made that up. It's scary. This feeling isn't scary. It's however you think it to be. And in that next moment, I thought it to be an overwhelming privilege that I get to feel. And it just changed. And then I moved on, carried on cooking dinner or cleaning clothes off the floor, whatever I was doing.
Right. Well, it sounds like in the moment you got really overwhelmed. But then when you actually took a bit of a step back, you were able to see, make a choice to see it in a different way.
Yeah.
That I'm lucky to feel this intense level of love for somebody that a lot of people aren't parents or a lot of people never feel this way in their life.
Yeah.
Even though at the time it was like, oh, big emotion.
For a minute.
Yeah.
Recognised that it was just the thought that was attaching that to that feeling of that word. I came up with these words about scary, you know, terrified, overwhelmed, what am I going to do, all these little things. And then when I kind of just thought, it just let it go, it was like it just flowed like thoughts do. I could have stayed in the anxiety, could have stayed in that moment with it, but it just moved through. It was amazing. And that was only last week, and it kind of said, you know, again, cemented some of my thoughts and my approach in my coaching now. Thought how powerful thought is. Sometimes we forget that. We let that outside thing take over.
Mm-hmm. And so having been through the experiences you've described, some of them being very traumatic, how does that inform your work and your outlook now?
I've been a coach. I qualified, I think my first coaching qualification was maybe 15 years ago. I've always worked within psychology and business psychology, and now I work with athletes and people who, I guess, quite high performers in their work, but maybe personally there's some things that are holding them back from performing even more, mm-hmm. and reaching their true potential. And a lot of that is based around thought, dare I say, all of it. So I work with people now in my coaching practice who, I work with anybody who needs a hand to really fulfil their true potential. Anybody, but I work with athletes a lot. Sport's my thing. I've always played sport. I love it. And that's where my own business has started to develop at the moment within sport and understanding, you know, that personal growth for young people.
Mm-hmm. And from what I understand about your work, there is a lot of mental health issues that crop up with your clients, and sometimes that's sort of preemptive work you end up doing with them, and sometimes that's existing illnesses that they need some support that's maybe very practical and career focused in a way that we might get other types of support from medical professionals. How has that been kind of developing since doing the podcast? And
I mean, this podcast has been amazing. I mean, we've worked together for nearly a year now, haven't we? But it's really opened my eyes up to a more clinical side of mental illness, I think. I've always worked, as I said, in business with leadership psychology. So you always try to be unblocking to help people perform better. And I've come away from that because I'm not that interested anymore in businesses performing to the best that they can be to feed into this capitalist world and make more money. I'm more interested in the health and well-being of our society and the people in it.
Yeah, that you've got, it sounds like, you've really transitioned to a more person-centred perspective.
100%. I mean, that's always been there, but the job came to me and I did all right and carried on with it. And you fall into that, you know, 15 years in business. So you make money, you live your life, you have your family, you know, all those kind of things. But I went into psychology in the first place because I am person-centred. There's no way around getting around that. But yeah, I'm more interested in that now in my day-to-day work, definitely. Absolutely love it.
Good. I think that's a nice positive place to finish that.
Yeah.
So we'll finish up there. Is there any last message you'd want to leave on our 100th episode?
You'll always be okay to anybody that's listening. Like, you will always be okay. And there is support. We all know that there's support out there. But even internally, we've got it. We've all got it within us, that ability to find that place. It just really feels hard sometimes, but it's there. And my email address, which is hogan.danielle80@gmail.com. If anybody wants to email me or ask me any questions or wants to work with me, then please don't, you know, please get in touch or through this podcast, because I'm here every week too.
I totally agree with that. I think I would amend it slightly in that I think you can always be okay. I think there are times when we need external support,
yeah,
to get through things. And there are examples, I think, even with your personal life, where potentially people would have been okay, yeah, had they had different kind of support.
Absolutely, because obviously what's happened to me in my past, my uncle wasn't okay in the end, and it's had a big impact. But I also want to say, so you're absolutely right, Bobby, but I also want to say just before I go that it's really important for anybody out there who we don't need to be mentally ill before we talk to people and get support and start opening up and finding about who we are and, you know, how our minds work and how we feel about things. And that with this campaign on this podcast, you know, with mental health education in school, all of that is so important. And with adults, anybody that's listening, like, it's, I want to be proactive in my work with understanding how we operate and our emotional well-being, really, not reactive. I don't want, you know, in sport, people go to the psych when there's an issue. Like, all young people entering any work or college or sport, education, everything, relationships, should have that person to talk to, somebody that we can start opening up to, not waiting until people are ill to then find some repair. And that's where I'd love us to get to. Let's be more proactive in our communication and kindness and courage, you right. know, helping each other.
100%. And if people want to learn more about our petition, if they're new to the podcast, the link for that is in the episode description, where we are campaigning for mental health education in all schools across the UK. So we'll finish up there then. Thank you. Thank you so much for being our guest this
you're
week.
You're welcome. I loved it.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.